Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Well, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Joe Rathmanner, and I'm here with my buddy Ryan. We're talking about some challenging subjects today on this beautiful day. I'd love to talk about roses and flowers and walking through the gardens and joy. But that is not what we're going to be talking about today.
No.
So I asked Ryan, what would you say about conflict if you had something to say about conflict that you may have with other people? And what did you say?
I said I would run into the other state if possible or the other country or across the county line to avoid conflict.
Well, that's actually one of the sections of what our distinguished guest has written about is avoiding conflict and how we all do try to do that to some extent.
Well, yeah, it's funny because we all know that we're going to have to deal with conflict on a very, very consistent basis. And yet that doesn't really help us all the time to do it. It just people like me, it makes us want to run.
Absolutely. It's like the warning light that shows up on your dashboard. Now, you have a couple of choices. Can you deal with the problem? You stop, you go into the shop, something to figure out why you have the warning light on. Or you take a piece of tape and you put it over the warning light and you ignore it. But eventually, something bad is going to happen.
Well said.
Yes.
Well
so, said. Yes, I have dealt with that, of course, in my own life. I'm sure you probably have as well. Maybe you have a conflict with a colleague or in your professional life. Maybe you have a conflict with a spouse or a parent or maybe a child, someone in your family, or maybe a good friend. But most of us in some way, shape, or form have dealt with having to resolve conflict or wanting to resolve conflict in our lives. You know, Jesus says that we're supposed to turn the other cheek, and I can do that, but I cannot seem to turn my brain off of thinking about all the things that I want to say or should have said.
And emotions, too. Mm-hmm. When I think about conflict, I think of emotions. Like, mm-hmm. even if I logically know that I want to say a certain thing, those just kick in, and I'm all of a sudden all a fumble.
Absolutely. In fact, I remember a time when I was at the gym and I was running on the treadmill and I was having a conversation in my brain that I wanted to have with someone I was in a deep conflict
totally.
With. And someone I knew actually came up to me and said, "You look so angry. What is going
Whoa.
On?" And that was really convicting to me just to think, yes, I guess I am angry. Mm. I need to talk to that person. And then, of course, it wasn't that bad at all. So we're going to learn some coping mechanisms, how to deal with conflict resolution, and most importantly, how to do it biblically. What does Christ call us to do when we are in conflict with another person or group of people? Do you call an attorney right away? That's probably not the choice. We're going to learn some better ways to deal with conflict. So let me introduce you to our guest, and we can get started. Ken Sandy is my guest today. He's the founder of Peacemaker Ministries and the president of a new ministry, Relational Wisdom 360. He's trained as a mechanical engineer and lawyer, but Ken is passionate about bringing the life-changing power of the gospel to the life of Christians and to their churches as well. He has used biblical peacemaking principles to minister to people in hundreds of conflicts, ranging from those simple personal disputes like I was talking about to complex legal conflicts. He's the author of The Peacemaker, which has been translated into 15 languages and has written numerous books, articles, and training resources on biblical conflict resolution and relational wisdom. He and his wife, Corlette, are delighted to be grandparents. They love to hike with their family in the mountains near their home in Billings, Montana. Beautiful area there, Ken.
You betcha. We call it the porch of heaven, Joe.
Oh, that is wonderful. Well, welcome to the show, Ken. Glad to have
Thanks
you
so
here.
Much.
Have you heard people talk about conflict in the way Ryan and I were musing?
That's what's kept me in business for 32 years.
Because you can't avoid it. It keeps happening.
No, one of our sayings is, where two or three come together in Jesus' name, there will soon be conflict.
I might have to use that once or twice.
Yeah.
Well, you began Peacemaker Ministries over 30 years ago with a mission to equip and assist Christians and their churches to respond to conflict biblically. What led you to found this ministry and really dig deep into helping people and churches resolve conflict?
Well, I had a background in engineering. I very quickly got into a management position with a team of wonderfully gifted people, but hard drivers. And I suddenly realized in 5 years of schooling, I hadn't had 5 minutes of teaching on how to deal with people. which is really the biggest challenge you face in any profession, engineering, economics, business, you name it. So I went back to law school thinking that would help me, but I discovered law schools don't teach anything about dealing with people as well. And when I got out of law school a few years later, I just thought I'd rather devote my training to helping people deal with the relational issues, and particularly the conflict issues at that time, that are part of everyday life, marriages, families, churches, ministries, buying and selling a car, you name it. So we started Peacemaker Ministries in 1982. It was under the auspices of the Christian Legal Society, a national fellowship of Christian attorneys. And the focus at that time was primarily, at the beginning, was mediating and arbitrating lawsuits between Christians. But we quickly branched out into education, realizing that an ounce of prevention is worth about $50,000 of legal fees, and began training Christian conciliators in all around the country, actually eventually around the world, and especially equipping people in local churches that when members have got some kind of conflict, whether it's a marital breakdown or problems between the pastor and the leadership team or lawsuits between members. And by the way, church members do a lot of business with each other. They employ each other. They buy and sell things with each other. So we train people in local churches to mediate and arbitrate those things. So that was basically 30 years, and we just saw God do some absolutely incredible things in that process.
So what does it mean to respond to conflict biblically?
Well, we organized our training into four key principles, Joe. One is to glorify God. When I'm in a conflict, my human reaction is to vindicate myself, justify myself, look out for myself. And God calls us, whatever we do, whether we eat or drink or whatever kind of activities we're involved in, we should be doing it all to the glory of God, meaning that our behavior would reflect well on God. People would see the character of Christ in us. They would see God's patience, kindness, mercy, forgiveness, our sense of justice and doing what's right by others. That at the end of the process, people say, wow, seeing you, I think more of your God. The second G is to get the log out of your own eye, is to take responsibility for my contribution to the conflict before I try to point out what the other person did. Again, that's just the opposite of what we do in our own sinful nature. Third G is to gently restore. How do I offer correction or confrontation to the other person in a way that would motivate him or her to listen and to say, you know, thank you. I hadn't seen it that way. That's an area I can grow. And then fourthly is to go and be reconciled, is to negotiate a just and satisfactory solution on the material issues, and then also to be personally reconciled with people through forgiveness and reconciliation. So that was the basic process we used over and over again in thousands and thousands of conflicts.
So what happens when people want to engage in this reconciliation, but the person that you're in the conflict with refuses to engage in that reconciliation?
Well, it depends a lot on the situation, Joe. Sometimes we just need to overlook things, and the Bible places a high premium on overlooking offenses. It's a sign of Christian maturity. But if there's issues that are too serious to overlook, and that's one thing we help people really think and pray through, is this something too serious to overlook, then we would equip the one willing individual on how to go back to the other person in the most winsome way possible. And a lot of people have tried to talk with the other person, but they haven't done it very thoughtfully. They just quickly resort into justifying themselves and pointing out the other person's wrongs, and a lot of things just shut down the conversation. So we spent a lot of time just coaching the willing party on how to go and still try to engage the other person, how to appeal to them, et cetera. And in many cases, they were then able to draw the other person in. But if that didn't work, then we would turn to the party's churches. If they're professing Christians, we believe the Bible says that the church should get involved, initially offering in a very low-key way. But if it's a serious dispute, the church's involvement is really not optional. And Jesus in Matthew 18 talks about the church having leaders go with the willing party to the other party and just saying, we really want to help you resolve this, and we need to do this.
One of the things I loved about some of what you wrote is that if someone does seem like they're not quite ready to have a conversation or deal with a conflict at hand, that just because you try once and they are not responsive to you does not mean at all that you should just throw in the towel and give up, but that it's very much like planting that seed, even sharing the gospel, that the response may not be what you wanted at first, but you've taken that first step and then need to be patient in going back and still remaining open to having that conversation. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely true. In fact, I'm working with one businessman who had a very painful falling out with a couple of colleagues about 3 years ago, and he really tried, bent over backwards to try to satisfy their expectations, finally made some pretty major concessions in terms of partnership distribution of assets, but he was just grieved by the breach in the relationship. That's what troubled him the most. And so he has just gently, lovingly pursued both of these other men for 3 years. And every once in a while, he'd send him a birthday card, he'd send him an email with an article he saw that was he knew would be of interest to them, and he just kept reaching out. And just recently, the Lord has softened the heart of one of those men, and he has said, you know, I've really been wrong in this. You keep reaching out to me. We do have a broken relationship. That's not where God wants us to be. And they should be sitting down here very shortly, actually, with a mediator to try to talk through a personal reconciliation.
Well, we're talking with Ken Sandy today, and we're talking about conflict resolution and how to do it biblically. We're going to take a short break, but we'd love to hear if you have some comments on this subject, or maybe you've been in a conflict and have a question you'd like to ask Ken. He's got over 30 years of experience dealing with people who are in conflict with Peacemaker Ministries. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what he's doing now and trying to prevent the conflict before it even began. So love to hear more from Ken Sandy coming up on Connecting Faith. For joining us today. We're talking about conflict resolution, whether it's personal or professional or maybe a very big conflict, and how we can resolve those biblically. Talking with Ken Sandy today, he's the founder of Peacemaker Ministries and president of a new ministry called Relational Wisdom 360. Ken, tell me how you came to found this new ministry and why you felt it was necessary, given all of your experience with Peacemaker Ministries.
Well, there's a variety of reasons, Joe. Probably most of all is, you know, I'd come home from some of the mediations, and we'd see marriage, you know, divorce papers torn up. We'd see churches decide not to split. Wonderful reconciliations and just evidence of God's grace. But I'd often go and tell my wife, I'd say, Corlette, you know, they didn't have to get right up to the edge of the cliff before they decided to really take God seriously about how to do relationship. So I hated to wait until there's a crisis before people began looking seriously at these principles. And then secondly, I also knew that even when there had been confession and forgiveness, there were some relational scars that wouldn't go away for a long time, if ever. Things people said and did that would still be in their memory banks. So how do we basically prevent that kind of harm, essentially get upstream of conflict? And so I just about 2 years ago decided I'd really like to develop a whole new generation of resources. And we decided that the board and I at Peacemaker, we talked it over, and their focus was still going to be on conflict resolution. And so just basically decided it was time to just step down, let some new blood come in there, and just launch something that would have a slightly different focus, still very, very compatible with peacemaking, but just would have this upstream focus. So that's when Corlette and I launched Relational Wisdom 360, RW360 for short. And our new ministry focuses mostly on building strong relationships, communication, empathy, reading people better, understanding others better. Still includes a very strong element of conflict resolution. All the principles that are in the Peacemaker are included in our new material. But that's just a small slice of the pie now. Most of it is how do we actually avoid those conflicts by building strong relationships in the first place.
And by avoiding, you mean not getting in that situation in the first place, not avoiding by being ensconced in your room where you are physically avoiding the conflict, correct?
Exactly. It'd be the kind of thing where you're in a meeting with your ministry team or a business team in your company having a conversation, and you say something that offends somebody, Now, if you're not sensitive to reading other people, you'll step on people's toes, walk out of the room oblivious, and but you'll just notice there's sort of some sand in the gears in that relationship in the weeks and months ahead. Bitterness ensues, jealousy, resentment, all those things. And then much, much later, things explode, and you wonder, where did this come from? Well, if you develop relational wisdom, and one of our six key skills is other awareness, in that meeting, when you throw out some idea and you're looking around at that group of people and you notice someone's, their face just suddenly fall. You know, the Bible talks a lot about someone's countenance falling. You can read that. It's a communication signal that someone is troubled by what you just said. And so if you pick up on that, you can, you know, right away. I mean, you could take a break in the meeting, step into another room and say, you know, Joe, I noticed a sort of reaction when I said something. I'm afraid I've offended you. Can you help me understand this? And get right to the bottom of it before it turns into a conflict.
Why does it seem so difficult for us to actually have that conversation where you do step into another room and say, I noticed this, and can we talk about it? It seems like we are more prone to kind of ignore it and hope it goes away.
Well, that's so true, Joe. There's just a lot of people that are wired to avoid conflict. They just don't like it. And part of the reason for that is they lack good relational skills. And it's like me. You won't get me on a golf course. I'm not good at golfing, so I don't like to do it. And if people are not good at doing relationships about communicating, listening, responding, receiving correction, sharing, you know, things are a little bit challenging, they're just going to avoid it. So one of the best ways to get more comfortable dealing with these issues is to immerse yourself in what the Bible says about relationships. And there's a wealth of information. Really understand how the gospel has a bearing right there, right in the middle of that conversation on your relationship and the offense you've given. Then you have confidence. And to use a golf parallel, if you're really good at golf, guess what? You love getting out on a golf course. If you really learn relational skills, guess what? You'll enjoy engaging other people.
Oh, that is so encouraging, because I think that we tend to think if we're not good at having those conversations, or we're not, quote, confrontational, then we're never going to be good at that. But I have found that when you're in a different relationship, that you do need to invest in that. And that really shows to me if someone's in conflict with me and they actually want to engage in a conversation to find out what's going on, that is really meaningful to me, versus I can tell when someone's avoiding me. And to me, that kind of rings that maybe my relationship isn't worth it to them to be in that uncomfortable situation. So it seems very encouraging that you're just telling us invest in what the Bible has to say about being in relationship and then start putting it into practice. Otherwise, how are we going to get any better?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This seems to sound a lot like EQ or emotional intelligence seems to be kind of a buzzword in the secular or corporate world right now. How is this different than EQ?
Well, EQ, or emotional intelligence, EI, or EQ is sort of a parallel to IQ. Those are terms that are becoming very popular in the business world, in fact, in all areas. If you go on the website, look it up, you'll see NFL football teams, special forces in the military, diplomats, business people, healthcare. They're all immersing themselves in this new concept of emotional intelligence. And what it is, basically, it's a form of behavioral psychology. I would call it common grace insights into how people get along. And there's a lot of very valuable information there of people who've studied some of the, how we get along more effectively with other people. And there's four basic skills that they talk about in all the training is self-awareness, you know, what am I feeling right now? And then self-management, how do I manage my emotions? If I'm really feeling angry or irritable, do I just blow up at somebody or do I manage them? Do I step aside, take a few minutes, take a walk, whatever? The other two skills is social awareness, how well do I read other people, either individually or a group? And then social management, how well do I manage the relationships with other people? And this is big-time business in the corporate world. FedEx and McDonald's just did major two-year studies globally and found out that the strongest predictor of professional advancement and productivity in their companies is connected to people's relational skills or emotional intelligence, not to their GPA or their IQ or their certifications, whatever. It's how we get along with other people. So what we've done, Joe, is we've looked at that information. There's a lot of valuable things there, especially about how the brain works, about how emotions come into it. But we're filling in something that is missing, and that's God. God designed relationships. He designed people. And when you look to what he says about relationship, when you seek to model human relationships after the perfect relationship in the Holy Trinity, when you embrace the gospel and bring that into everyday life, it supercharges relationships. It supercharges the principles of emotional intelligence.
So how do emotions fit into this paradigm? I know that I've been told that emotions do not have a place in my professional life, yet you write that we should not ignore what the Bible has to say about emotions, that is part of the way that God created us.
Yeah. Joe, if anyone tells you emotions have no place in your emotional life, that's your professional life, that's like saying stop breathing when you walk into the office. You have to breathe. You cannot exist without taking another breath. And we have emotions. But you're right. In the Christian community, and I'd say especially the conservative Christian community, there is this tendency to stuff emotions, just think that they're all just so tainted by sin, we just need to stuff them in the closet. And if you just have the right doctrine, just have the right theology, then you'll be okay. Think right and everything will be okay. Well, start reading the Bible with just looking for the emotion. The Bible is filled with emotion. Jesus is described as having countless emotions. The difference with him is his emotions never moved him to sin. That's the huge difference between Jesus and us. But he had emotions of compassion, of sympathy, of anger, of concern, of being just agonizing emotions, but he never sinned. Now with us, we have a lot of emotions. You read the book of Psalms, they are filled with emotion. King David is constantly talking about the inner turmoil, his fears, his concerns, his anger, his uncertainties, jealousy, all those things. And there's countless passages in the Bible teaching us to recognize our emotions and on how to manage them. And what we need to realize is our emotions are really triggered out of our brain, the limbic area of our brain specifically, and God is the one who designed and gave us our brain for the capacity both for rational thinking, for remembering things, for worshiping, for feeling compassion, love, tenderness, kindness, and also the other emotions that we wrestle with because of sin. So to me, pastors in particular should be careful students of the brain, of neurology, of the hormones that certain emotions release into our system and cause measurable physiological changes in us. Our heartbeat goes up, our breathing gets more rapid, our muscles tense up. Those are all emotional responses to certain stimuli that we need to understand.
Valuable information from Ken Sandy. He's the founder of Peacemaker Ministries and Relational Wisdom 360, catching those conflicts before they even start. We're talking about how to solve conflicts with biblical wisdom and what steps we can take to maybe avoid them before we get into a position where we can't any longer. Maybe you have a story you'd like to tell or a question for Ken. Give us a call, 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. We'll get that question on the air, or you can go online at myfaithradio.com. And submit it via email, and I can ask Ken that question for you. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. So great to have you with us this afternoon. You know, one of the things we love to do on this show is really connect your faith to the challenges that we face during our lives. And conflict is something that seems to be almost unavoidable, but boy, there are some great ways in order to make it less. And so we're talking with Ken Sandy. He's the founder of Peacemaker Ministries as well as RW360. And we've just been talking about emotions a little bit on what happens when our emotions get the best of us. I know I was just sharing with Ryan over the break that if I could learn that one thing, which is how to manage my emotions when I'm offended, I would save many, many conflicts from even starting, Ken. So talk a little bit about that that emotional hijacking that occurs in our human brain?
Well, emotional hijacking, also called the amygdala hijacking, is a concept where impulses get to the emotional part of our brain, the limbic system, specifically one part called the amygdala, and that's where you store sort of emotional memories. And sensations get there first, a few nanoseconds before they reach the prefrontal cortex, where you do your reasoning. And what that means is you can react to things emotionally before you think about them. So that's what happens when a young mother who's been with her kids all day and she's getting more and more frustrated, and finally just one little thing sets her off and she just screams at her four-year-old and immediately feels guilty about it. It'd be someone in a meeting in the office is frustrated by what a boss says and just throws out some sarcastic, disrespectful comment, and even before the period's on the sentence, wishing he could take it back. That's amygdala hijacking. We speak and act before we think. And so learning, how do we actually respond and manage those things? There's an acrostic that we've developed, Joe. We like to reduce all these complicated principles down to very simple acrostics so people can remember them. And it's simply that if you want to get better at your own self-awareness and self-management, read, R-E-A-D, yourself carefully. And what that means is read is to recognize the emotion. What am I feeling right now? Anger, jealousy, bitterness, resentment, joy, delight, whatever it is. Learn to recognize your emotion. Many people have never done that. It's like an invisible puppeteer in the background just jerking us along. We never even stop to think, what am I feeling? Second part, E, is to evaluate the source of that emotion. Where is this coming from? You know, I'm jealous of this coworker. I'm frustrated with my husband. I'm tired of being home with these kids all day. So really trying to understand what's going on inside of me, getting to the heart of these issues. James 4:1 talks about fights and quarrels coming from our passions that war within us. We have to recognize those passions. The third step is to anticipate the consequences. What's going to happen if I let this emotion push me forward and I do what I feel like doing? I say something really, unkind to my young child or my boss or something. We think it through. What we're trying to do is move out of that emotional part of our brain, move up into that part of the brain that is the reasoning part, the impulse control that thinks about long-term consequences. So anticipate the consequences. Then the fourth one, it's direct. D, direct those emotions on a constructive course. What's the positive thing to do? Now, let me give you something that is just so simple. One guy I was working with who was always throwing out little cute, sarcastic comments in staff meetings, he just couldn't stop himself. And one of the quick fixes we helped him with, just to get a little bit of progress, was to, when he goes into a meeting, take a bottle of water, put it on the table in front of him, and just that he would never say anything without first taking that bottle of water, taking the lid off, taking a sip, putting it back down. The 4 or 5 seconds that it takes to do that is all you need to get that reasoning part of your brain engaged. It's like the old adage, count to 10, take a walk, spend some time in prayer. Now, there's a lot of practical ways to put all those things in practice. And, in fact, there's a page on our website on 4 ways to defeat hijacking, and it just illustrates these things. And there's actually a couple of wonderful video clips out of the movie, the Russell Crowe movie, Cinderella Man, where Renee Zellweger does a great example of hijacking, where she blows up at her children, says things, and deeply regrets them in moments. But then later in the movie, when she is showing much more control over her emotions and how she's supporting her husband in a very critical situation. So the movie itself is a beautiful illustration of these concepts, and we've itemized several things that people can do to actually defeat this emotional hijacking.
Boy, that timing that you're talking about just seems like a nugget of gold, to be able to have those few seconds to think about what it is that you're going to say. Because I think for a lot of us, we do react right away. And then later on, our logic says, what in the world was I thinking? Of course they didn't mean that. You know, this is someone who loves me or cares about me. But it doesn't seem like that happens in the spur of the moment.
That's exactly it. If you could just buy those few seconds, it makes all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. Hey, we have a caller calling in with a question, and I'm just going to throw this out to you, and you can answer it on the air if you would, Ken. She says, what do you do if a church that you're working at will refuse to help her reconcile?
Oh, it's such a sad situation, Joe. Of course, it depends on a lot of facts, a lot of particulars, how much she's gone and appealed, who she's talked to. You know, one thing I've often done is just have people just get one of our resources. And number one, if you come on strong, if you've got a critical attitude, if the leaders feel like putting them down, they're going to just put up walls. So a lot of this has to do with your demeanor, your attitude, how gracious you are. But I've talked to a lot of people who went back to the church, and sometimes they had to start off by saying, you know, I need to ask your forgiveness. Maybe talking to the pastor or an elder and say, you know, I came on too strong. I know I was being judgmental in that attitude, and I'd really ask you to forgive me. I know you're very busy, and you've got a lot of things to do, and so please forgive me. So let's get in a log out of your own eyes. Sometimes that's the first step. And then secondly, say, explain why it's so important. You say, Pastor, I want so much to be reconciled with this other woman in our church. We've been friends for years. She's not speaking to me. I hate to have a division here. I'm afraid it would affect the ministry. And I really think there's a great opportunity for us to learn how to live out the gospel, and I'd love to have you help us. In fact, here's a resource I found that might be helpful to us, and maybe get a copy of The Peacemaker or Resolving Everyday Conflict and just give it to the pastor and say, you know, could you critique this? Read it. See what you think. If you think there's valuable principles here, I'd love to have you help me learn how to live this out, because I not only need it in this relationship with this other woman in the church, but I need this at home with my husband and my kids. And you're my pastor. I want to be under your teaching and your direction, and I just really want your help. Please help me.
So really coming to anyone who you have a conflict with in a spirit of humility seems to really be the key to having that conversation and not making things worse, correct?
It's huge. In fact, there's an adage we've got, Joe, is we call it the golden result. It's a corollary to the golden rule. And the golden result is people will usually treat you how you're treating them. So if you come to people and you're being driven by pride, condemnation, judgment, criticism, don't be surprised if they resist you and do the same back. But if you come with humility, gentleness, graciousness, more often than not, you're going to see a better response.
Sure. I hope that answered your question, caller, and that you got some tips on how to resolve that conflict. If not, you can certainly email in another question. I can get that on the air as well. Ken, can relational wisdom have something to do, have some good effect on someone who's a non-Christian? I mean, we're talking about biblical principles here, but you may be speaking with someone who doesn't know anything about the Bible or doesn't ascribe to the principles within it. Can we still use these to help them resolve conflict?
Absolutely. The Bible is filled with stories of people with faith, interacting with unsaved people. I mean, God knows this is the reality of our lives. And these principles are absolutely vital. In fact, I'd have to say the thing that drew me to Christ in my early 20s was seeing the quality of Christian relationships, specifically Christian marriages. I just saw there's something they have that I want. So it's a huge part of our Christian witness that people would see us, not that we have perfect relationships, but that we're transparent. Even when we struggle, we talk about how God helps us to resolve those issues and keep working and reconciling. But the principles absolutely apply, Joe. All the acrostics that we use are directly relevant. I apply them as I travel, as I go through airport terminals, as I deal with people at Starbucks, as I deal with hotel people. I'm constantly living out the relational wisdom principles we've got on our website. And just being kind to people, showing an interest in people, being empathetic to people. When you communicate, most of your message is going to come across in your eyes, your facial expression, your tone of voice, your body language. Learning how to use those parts of our communication package to engage other people, even non-Christians, can greatly enhance. And again, getting back to emotional intelligence, this is why corporations are spending millions of dollars teaching these skills to their managers, to their HR people, and some of them all the way the entire organizations being taught, because they see these principles work in even a secular organization.
We have several callers calling in, and I'd love to read another question for you. But first, I'd like to get a caller on the air who'd like to ask you personally. John, are you there?
No, I don't think John is there.
No, John?
Right quite yet, Joe.
Oh, sorry. John's not there yet. He's still thinking about his question. No, I'm sure he has it. Let me read you this one, Ken. It says, one of the things I struggle with in potential conversations after a conflict has already arisen is kind of sticking up for myself and not letting the other individual just roll over me. Is that something I can get better at, or am I just looking the wrong way to begin with?
No, absolutely. It's a great question, and it is absolutely an area people can get better with. Again, part of that is confidence. Part of it is learning how to communicate. If somebody who's intimidated by others easily would just practice that read acrostic, READ, recognize your emotion, evaluate its source, anticipate consequences, direct it constructively. As they do that in the little discussions of the day, just the ones that are not threatening, not overwhelming, just practice that skill set again and again and again. It's like playing the piano. You start with very simple little tunes, and eventually you're doing, entire big pieces. And the same thing in relationships. So learning how to practice these things on the little things in life eventually can give you the ability. You might be in the conversation and you're starting to feel some anxiety. You feel your stomach is tightening up. You can sense that your heart rate is going up, and you're reading yourself. You're saying, okay, I'm getting nervous right now. And when I get nervous, my tendency is to shut down, escape, and just give in to people. And you can take a deep breath. I mean, just a real long deep breath can calm you down. You can think through, okay, I'm not going to be intimidated. I don't have to be intimidated. I know what I think is right in this case. I can at least share my views in a constructive way. And sometimes it would even involve just having a break. Just when you feel yourself getting tense or intimidated, just say, hey, could I have a break for just a moment? I need to go get a drink of water, or I need to take a call, or I need to just step out and think about this for a moment. Sometimes just buying a few minutes to think, to pray, to organize your thoughts, and then go back into the conversation. It's amazing how much better we can get in those hard conversations.
Excellent advice. I love the taking a break thing. Can give you your mind a chance to catch up maybe with your emotions. We're talking with Ken Sandy today. Ken is the founder of Peacemaker Ministries and RW360. We're talking about conflict resolution, and the phone lines are lighting up. I'll try to get your calls right after this break so that you can garner some wisdom from Ken Sandy. We will be right back on Connecting Faith. Forgiven. Great reminder that we're forgiven and then we get to forgive. Conversation I've had many times with my children, often after I need to be forgiven. We came up with a slogan with my kids, even when they were little, that we are a family that forgives. And I think that I came up with that mainly because they needed to forgive me for exactly what you were talking about, where at the end of the day, your emotions are at the end. You're struggling. You're having a difficult time. And just to remember that we are a family that forgives, and if we do say something wrongly or that offends someone, that we need to get back right with them just like God gets right with us. So great advice from Ken Sandy, who is the who has just launched a new ministry called RW360. He's been dealing with conflict resolution and how to do that biblically for over 30 years, and now RW360 talks about preventing those conflicts before they actually occur. Unfortunately, a lot of us have been in conflicts, and some of the questions that are coming in have to do with that. So I'd love to bring in an anonymous caller from Sioux Falls who has a question for you, Ken. Are you on the line?
I am. Thank you.
Go ahead with your question.
Oh, Mr. Sandy used the term overlooking an offense by another a little while ago. Maybe you could just elaborate on that. But also, maybe the same question is, does everybody have to get along? Do we all need to like each other in order to worship together?
Romans 12:18, Paul says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all people. So, yes, I think there is a call for us to, as far as we can, you know, impact a relationship, to try to get along with other people. But implicit in that statement is that sometimes the other person won't get along with us. And so we shouldn't drive ourselves crazy by the fact that we can't force other people to like us or agree with us or so on. But yes, we do need to make a reasonable effort to live at peace. And there's lots and lots of scriptures about that, that peace is a manifestation of God's presence in our midst. Now, I would add to that, though, let's not confuse unity in the church with uniformity. And we often do get those confused, that uniformity is that everybody has to think alike, talk alike, you know, value the same things, et cetera. And that's not true. There's different priorities. We may hold some different views on different issues in a church. And there's primary issues, there's secondary issues, and there's tertiary issues that can just be matters of opinion that shouldn't divide us. So, but back to your other question about when to overlook an offense. There's a whole section in my book, The Peacemaker, where we unpack some of the principles there. But basically, this is a quick way I would look at it. The offenses we should overlook, there's four questions we should ask ourselves. Number one, is the other person's conduct dishonoring God? Is there something he or she is doing that if other people look at him would think less of God? So that might be, you know, you see one of your church deacons going into pornography studio. You better be concerned about that, because that's going to bring disrepute on the Lord if people find out that, you know, a leader in the church is involved in something like that. Second question is this offense hurting other people? If you see a man in your church, for example, who is criticizing and demeaning his wife publicly, now, he's hurting his witness. He's also hurting his wife, his kids, et cetera. That's too serious to overlook. Is there a serious breach in your relationship? Is this something that even now, two or three days later, still when you think about it, you still feel hurt, angry, resentful, without whatever emotion? So it's still something that's clearly impacting your relationship with that other person. And then finally, is this conduct hurting the individual himself? Is he trapped in some kind of behavior? If he keeps doing this, you just know it's going to undermine his relationship with the Lord. It's going to keep him cut off from other people. And it really would be an act of love to go to that person and actually share your concern and try to help him break out of that pattern. So those are sort of the four general questions I would ask in a situation and whether or not it's too serious to overlook.
Well, and those kind of go back to those four G's that you started with of how can I glorify God in this? I need to get the log out of my own eye, gently restore, have that conversation, even if it may be difficult, and go and be reconciled in the pursuit of genuine forgiveness. And it seems like those kind of go hand in hand with what you're talking about of deciding whether or not it's an offense to be overlooked.
Absolutely. And the other thing I would add, Joe, is I think one of the marks of a mature Christian is we get an increasingly thick skin as to how people offend us. We get less and less easily offended. We can overlook things that are slights and things against us, but we develop a thinner and thinner skin into how we may have offended someone else. We become sensitive to the areas where we may have said or done something that would offend a brother or sister, and we would go quickly to try to make things right.
That's a great lesson to learn. We have another caller who has a question. I'm going to try to get this last one in. Jane from Woodbury is calling in. She has a question about someone who accuses you unjustly. Jane?
Yeah. Hi, Ken. I have a question. How do you respond biblically to somebody that you love? It's my sister and my sister who's accused you unjustly of something that you did not do, and then withdraws and will not discuss or converse and totally isolates herself from you so you can't go about a conversation. And this is after I have spent 4 years helping she and her family recover from a devastating illness. So I don't know how to go about this. Plus, she is partially hard of hearing. So anyway, there's the question, kind of multiple questions.
Yeah, it is. Well, Jane, of course, I'd love to, you know, get a lot more detail to fine-tune a response, because there's a lot of factors that could affect what to do. The one that I would point you to, the last chapter of my book, The Peacemaker, there's a section, what do you do with people who refuse to respond to you? And there's a lot of principles that can come to bear there. Is there another person that could intervene that you could ask, another family member, a mutual friend that might appeal to her and talk with her and reason with her? Is there someone you can turn to for advice just to sort of evaluate what your approach has been? Maybe there's something you've said or done that you're not even aware may have unnecessarily offended her. Another thing, and this is sort of the ultimate weapon when somebody just refuses to respond to us, Paul in Romans 12, he says, if your enemy's hungry, give him something to eat. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I've coached a lot of people over the years that when they ran out of all the other avenues, the other person just wouldn't respond to any kind of conversation, is just pray for God to give you ways to love on them. And that could be sending her a birthday card, a Christmas card, just things that show I still love you. I still care about you. I still want to be in a relationship with you. And sometimes that will go on for months or years. One case I had, it was 15 years that a woman kept reaching out to the other side before their heart softened. And again, going back to the Romans 12:18 verse I mentioned earlier in the program, where God says through Paul, if it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all people. It just says do what you can within your abilities. And once you've done all you can think of, then you just need to say, Lord, that's all I can think of today. If there's something else I can do tomorrow that I'm not aware of now, open my eyes to it. In the meantime, I'm going to give this relationship to you, and I will keep praying for her. You can always pray for your sister. She sure can't stop that.
Thanks so much for your call, Jane. I hope that helped. You know, Ken, you've talked about so many different ways and resources that people can use in order to help manage conflict better. And I'd love for you to tell our listeners how they might be able to get a hold of some of these resources, and then we can also put them up on our website as well.
Great. Thank you so much for that offer, Joe. Yeah, we have a lot on our website. You can go. There's articles. There's about 100 different blog posts. Just did a whole recent series, for example, on empathy. How do we develop empathy, and how do we raise empathetic children? You know, my kids someday are going to be taking care of me when I'm an old man. I sure want to have children who are kind and compassionate and gentle and gracious looking out to me. Well, I can teach them those qualities today by God's grace. So there's a whole series of blogs on a variety of topics that many of your readers would have. We have a training program that's online with a video series. They go to our website, and there's just a link that says videos. And there's a 5.5-hour video seminar called Discovering Relational Wisdom. We go into a lot of detail on all of these concepts. And if people want to, they can go on for more advanced training to become a presenter, teaching a Sunday school class or small group study in their church, or a certified instructor in relational wisdom. We also have a bookstore on our website that people can go and get many of the books we've talked about in our discussions. There's other peacemaking resources over at Peacemaker Ministries, and that's peacemaker.net. They've got a very wide array that we develop during my time there. But I would say the most important thing, let's do one thing, is go to our website and sign up for the blog. Every Monday morning, we just have a short little lesson, and that's just rw360.org/blog. They can find all these things. But I especially think this recent series on empathy and raising empathetic children, hijacking, those are all very relevant to everyday life.
Well, and it seems that if you look at our culture today, and I worry for my children as well, that it does seem much more self-focused. And so developing that quality of empathy to actually see, feel, and hear the needs of others and be able to then respond to them seems like a quality that if we have any control in developing, we should definitely do that.
Well, absolutely. And here's what should motivate us, Joe. Jesus Christ is the most relational, the most empathetic, the most compassionate person who ever walked the face of the earth, and one of his specific commands is that we are to imitate him, to walk as he walked. So none of this is optional, actually. All of this is something that God is calling us to do, that we might reflect his character, his grace, his love, and ultimately draw people to him through our example and our witness.
And thanks so much for your words of wisdom and for helping encourage us all that we can deal with conflict
better, and that we will have some resources to do so. You can check out all of the resources Ken was talking about at rw360.org. We'll have that on our website as well. We'll have a link to that, so you can check out those resources and his books if you want to take a look at that as well. Thanks so much for joining us, Ken.
Pleasure to be with you, Joe. God bless you.
You too. Have a great day. You've been listening to Connecting Faith. Have a wonderful afternoon.